Welcome to Conversations for a Brave New World with Donna, Sonia and Cliff, where we bring you a global, national and local focus on gender, sexuality and feminism.
Hello, I'm Donna Bridges, Associate Professor of Sociology at Charles Sturt University. Today on Conversations for a Brave New World, we're marking the 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence, a global campaign calling for an end to all forms of violence against women and girls. This year, the UN campaign turns its attention to digital violence, the ways that technology can be used to control, harm, and silence. At its core, this speaks to a broader and deeply damaging pattern of behaviour known as coercive control. It's a form of abuse that may not leave visible bruises, but systematically strips away a person's autonomy, safety, and sense of self. I'm joined by Dr. Jasmine McDonald, Research Fellow at the Australian Institute of Family Studies. Jasmine's research focuses on trauma and trauma reactions, as well as issues around intimate partner violence. Jasmine is also known for her vodcast Psych Attack, where she makes complex psychological ideas engaging and accessible for the wider community. If you're interested in Psych Attack, you can see our website for a link. Jasmine, welcome.
Thanks, Donna. I appreciate the chat.
Great. So let's start at the beginning. I'd like to nut out what coercive control is exactly in plain language for listeners, and also maybe how the Australian Institute for Family Studies defines it. I wonder if you can demystify it for listeners.
Yeah, Donna, when we talk about coercive control here at AAFES, we use the ANROS definition, so the Australia's National Research Organisation for Women's Safety. Coercive control definitions are not without their controversy. And lots of folks have been trying to really condense down a clear definition for a while. Coercive control is the overarching context that intimate partner violence happens within. It's really where there's an ongoing, repetitive, cumulative use of strategies and behaviours that impact, as you say, a victim survivor's autonomy, their sense of liberty and equality within a relationship. So I think that what we'll see as generally accepted is that ongoing repetitive nature, and we can talk a little bit about why that's important in terms of police response later. But what is a little less accepted is where this starts is a gendered violence issue. It was originally kind of thought of as intimate terrorism, which I think is a really quite a useful, probably useful for people to be aware of that, because that's what that experience is like. And typically it's gendered because this conceptualization or this idea of coercive control is that it's mostly a male power that's used over a female victim survivor. It's very much a gendered concept. Now, of course, with a legal response, we need to think more broadly than that. And we need to think about, you know, groups of people or types of relationships where we don't have as much information outside of like heteronormative relationships, because coercion can happen in same-sex relationships. Different kinds of violence can happen in a myriad of relationships. But really what we're talking about here is a male power, physical or non-physical, violence over a female victim survivor.
It actually sounds quite conscious and deliberate when you say it like that. Is it?
It absolutely is. The kinds of strategies and behaviours a perpetrator will use to control or subordinate a woman and children really is dependent on what's most important to that woman and their experience, right? So we could list a range of things like all our traditional types of family domestic violence, physical, emotional, sexual, financial, all of these things are relevant. But we're also talking about things like stalking behaviours, isolating a woman from family and friends, and really having them second guess their experience. Gaslighting quite commonly comes up. We know through more recent and emerging research is violence against pets. So perpetrator acting in violence or threatening violence to a family dog or cat to control a victim survivor. That's a very effective way to control somebody. We know with families where there is gender and sexual diversity, pets may play an even more important role, or people might identify more of their pets being part of their family. And so then this becomes a unique experience for some subpopulations. We need to understand more broadly, think about the nuanced ways people might be experiencing coercion and control.
So how common is it? Are we able to quantify?
Yeah, I think what we'd ideally like to be able to do is say, what's the actual prevalence of coercive control? Mm. But that's really tricky, Donna, and it's tricky because of the different definitions that people have used in research in Australia and internationally. One recent review found as many as 22 different definitions. And so that means people are using lots of different kinds of scales or thinking about that list of behaviours that might be coercive control. Those lists will be different study to study. So it is actually really tricky to say what the prevalence is. But what we can say in studies that have measured coercive control, what was the frequency? But it gives us a sense of how common this issue potentially is. And so there's two different kinds of ways that this has been looked at. And one is in the general population. So big representative studies across Australia asking people if they've experienced coercive control have found frequency rates of about 7% to 28%. Asking people whether they've experienced abuse can get you mixed response, because one of the issues with coercive control is whether or not someone realizes they're experiencing abuse or not. When we zoom into probably those areas of the community where this is most relevant and we look at what we might call clinical samples, groups of women who've already been at risk of coercive control because of access to domestic violence service or a women's shelter, or they've engaged in some kind of custody dispute with an ex-partner. In those types of samples, we see almost, in some cases, up to 100% of people sampled in those contexts say they've experienced coercive control. But we also see as low as 4%. So when we have a range that big, it's almost not helpful at all, Donna.
And what kinds of behaviours are people identifying? What's happening to them?
Yeah, so monitoring and surveillance, stalking behaviours, things that become, I guess, quite tricky to quantify and demonstrate the impact of, like where a perpetrator might become really jealous of a victim survivor spending time with other people and then trying to control or manipulate those relationships, being emotionally, physically or sexually abusive. And where we get to that quite contra-gendered aspect, it's the perpetrator thinking that they're superior to the victim, thinking that they're entitled to be dominant or to have ownership of the victim survivor. Mm-hmm. And then some gender things that roll out of that are controlling or being really critical of what the woman wears, their body shape and their weight, and a whole range of kind of gender-based contradictory expectations. So a perpetrator who could have plenty of female relationships but a female victim survivor who's expected to not have any relationships or friendships with men.
And could that extend to the workplace too then?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, like, I think this is a good point that you raise, because the impacts of coercive control psychologically and physically lead to absenteeism at work, sometimes for health reasons, but also psychologically. So there's this economic impact of coercive control. But then laid on top of that is the gendered perception of the importance of being at home, and also that restriction of professional relationships with the broader community, including men.
Yeah, so if somebody wanted to work, but their partner was saying, well, I don't want you to work, that could be part of it, or it's bad for the children, so I don't want you to do it, not wanting them to work on their careers, to extend themselves. Maybe they need to travel for their work or something like that to try and prevent them.
Yeah, all really practical examples, Donna, especially calling on grips of what it means to be a good mother. Because you're a woman and a mother, what you should be doing for our children, what you should be doing for me is... That's the tricky thing about this. You can absolutely imagine a situation where you could have two different women talking about, oh, my husband doesn't really like it when I travel, compared to My husband doesn't like it when I travel. I'm not allowed to have friends that they don't approve of or have contact with my family. I don't have control over my finances. I'm not allowed to go to a GP by myself. This kind of coercive control behaviour often means that women aren't able to go to health appointments themselves without a perpetrator there. So all of these things together, coupled with, because we've got to remember, it's not separate from other kinds of violence, sexual and physical violence are still present. It's seeing all these things together as a broader pattern that's really important, and how we get to the need for a legal response to raise awareness of that and better support.
So with psychological studies, which you are involved in, can you see the impact of coercive control on people? Like, what kind of effect does it have on them?
Yeah, Donna, most of the research has been that kind of psychological research that's focused on mental health outcomes. So we know that experience of trauma-related symptoms, so hypervigilance and depressive symptoms, stress and anxiety, all of these things. So we have people basically in fight or flight all the time. So that wears them down physically, and so can be associated with different health conditions. But we also see a decrease in decision-making abilities. Being undermined or having choices taken from you can lead women to then or to really struggle with decision-making when they do have the opportunity. And so where a mother is having these mental health and other impacts, we find family health and well-being also decreases, and that time taken off work. Very interestingly, what we don't see too much of is literature or research that said, hey, what's the economic cost of this? What's the cost for the broader family or our community or our workplaces? And I think that's really an important space for us to go forward, because what that says is this is a community issue. We need to come together to wrap around and have support and address this as a gendered societal issue.
It sounds like the person affected would become very anxious and apprehensive and uncertain about their own lives. And I suppose tiptoeing around, walking on eggshells.
Yeah, all of those things, right? We're not currently holding them accountable and set boundaries. You know, I'm not going to tell you where I am. I'm not going to constantly check in by text message. That's actually where violence and control escalates, because the perpetrator has a sense of losing control. We consulted with practitioners to complement our research perspective with what practitioners are seeing with families. And one of the practitioners told us that she worked with a young woman and said, oh, do you know that your ex-partner can see where you are? They can track you using your device. And she said, I know, but when I turn it off, that's when he contacts me. So if he knows where I am and what I'm doing, he has a sense of control, he doesn't bother me. And I think that's really important for us to keep in mind too, is like, what's that extra mental load and emotional responsibility that victim survivors are having to do to adapt? And it's like, it's socially invisible.
Yeah. So if you're in a situation where somebody said, we all have to turn our phones off, you would get nervous. That would concern you, wouldn't it? If you thought, I have to keep my phone on all the time so this person doesn't harass me.
Donna, that's a beautiful example, because the broader work that I do in trauma is like trying to understand unexpected behaviours in people, not as a problem with them, but what is it in their environment or their experience that leads to this behaviour? So you might have a colleague in the workplace or a family member who comes to an event and they're constantly checking their phone, or as you say, being asked to turn it off or have it collected. That could cause an immense amount of anxiety and could seriously lead to a violent response. It's actually quite a safety risk.
And before we had mobile phones, people often didn't know where we were. So now we're in this world with technology and phones and computers. And the UN theme for the 16 days of activism this year is to end digital violence against women and girls. And this is drawing attention to the use of technology to harass and to commit perpetration of coercive control. Can you tell us a bit more about digital violence?
Yeah, and that can look like a range of things. Probably the first thing that comes to mind to folks when I have conversations in a about intimate partner violence is, oh, bullying, trolling. Those are things that come under the umbrella of tech-facilitated abuse or digital abuse. And so tech-facilitated or digital-facilitated coercive control use technology as a means to monitor, maintain surveillance, and basically just extend the control that they have in the real world. But I guess that's when we get to a range of, like we were talking before about with coercive control, what are some of the behaviors or strategies that can be used? So thinking about everyday kind of technologies that people use, if I'm a perpetrator and I'm concerned about maybe disclosures, then maybe I'm looking out for my partner's emails and keeping track of, oh, you're getting an email or a message about a medical appointment or at a counseling service. So we need to think about services that we provide to victim survivors who, as we've talked about, have elevated mental health issues. So they might not disclose, but they might be getting supports for the struggles that they're having. And so we have to think really careful about, great, telehealth is excellent. That helps us reach remote women, people who are working at home with kids, but it can potentially increase the risk. But it's also stuff like recording or watching victim survivors through different devices in the house or on their phone. And we also shouldn't assume that that's always hidden. Sometimes folks know, like women will know that they're being recorded or watched, and they don't have the ability to stop it. Accessing accounts without permission. So social media accounts, that can often be used for trying to undermine, to further isolate. One that is increasingly being researched is doxing. A current or ex-partner publishing private information to threaten, control, shame a victim survivor. I think one of the things for us to think more about in the future is also content like videos or pictures that were originally created consensually being distributed later without consent or as a threat.
It increases the surveillance, doesn't it? I'm put in mind of people saying that children who are being bullied at school can't get away from the bullying. The bullying can keep going till 2 o'clock in the morning because it's coming through the smartphone. It would be the same kind of thing, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's right. There's no downtime. Yeah, and all of those things then are going to make it even harder.
And will it put them more at risk, like make it harder to leave?
Coercive control is present in every homicide in the country where a woman has been killed by a partner. Coercive control is consistently identified retrospectively there. One of the most common misconceptions is if you're experiencing violence, just leave the relationship. It's not that hard. It's not easy to leave. You don't have that time to make that planning. And of course, for women that have children or have animals, it becomes even trickier. Where do we all go?
So the difficulties leaving are increased by digital technology, because if you wanted to hire a truck or you wanted to communicate with somebody to help you, that would be made harder if somebody is surveilling your devices. That is so complex.
One of the really important things to think about the tech aspect of this or the digital aspect of this is to loop that thinking out. It seems intuitive to say, hey, turn your phone off, delete your social media account. But that will increase risk. And it also puts the responsibility on the woman, not on the behavior and the perpetrator.
Mm-hmm. And it's not fair. It's like, cut yourself off from the modern world. Don't participate because somebody is harassing you. It's like saying, why doesn't she just leave? Like, pick up the dog, the cat, the guinea pig, the kids. Or even if it's just yourself, the onus being on you to do the leaving, not on him, to say, well, geez, I'm clearly being a problem. I should leave. I was also thinking, too, about surveillance and other types of threats. If it's coming on your phone, then it's coming into your house, isn't it?
It's coming into your house. The perpetrator doesn't need to be in your house for you to be experiencing violence, right? I think sometimes of violence as this hierarchy of physical and sexual violence, so these things that happen in the real world, and that as long as that's not happening, it's not abuse. But there's a lot of fear and distress that can come from just the threat of those things. if we don't look at it as a series of behaviours, I guess we've got two issues. One is being taxed isn't the same as being physically assaulted. And the important thing to keep there in mind is that the research shows that these things happen hand in hand. It's not one or the other. The other aspect of this is that victim survivors will say, well, what's the point in reporting this? I'm not going to be believed. So I think there's just something about what level of control and omnipresence, always being everywhere and impacting the decisions a woman is making, going beyond whether there's physical violence as well.
And of course, sitting outside somebody's house, in your car, texting them is a threat. That is part of gendered violence, is the threat, is that the person is bigger and stronger and is somehow, whether it be outward aggression or passive aggressiveness, threatening you.
Absolutely, Donna. Yeah.
So, Jasmine, for listeners who might recognise some of these behaviours in their own relationships or in the relationships of somebody they care about, what would you want them to know? What would you want them to do next?
I think it's really important in that situation to ask questions and go slow with people. Relationships, even where we might not be talking about abuse, there's a lot of nuance and individual difference and a culture that builds up between two or more people when they're in an intimate relationship. So asking questions, going slow and trying to see things from the perspective of the victim survivor or the person, you know, your friend that you're worried about. And I think it can be useful. It's useful for everyone to have a sense of what coercive control is and that it exists and it's important. But we don't necessarily need to brandish that word when we're talking to our loved ones. So if you said to someone, I think you're experiencing tech abuse or I think you're experiencing coercive control, it's actually really uncommon for people to see themselves as a victim or to see themselves as experiencing abuse. So it could be, you know, pointing out what you're observing that concerns you, unpacking behaviours and experiences to work out how they're going, and I guess, yeah, moving away from you're experiencing abuse or not. What does that look like? What are you worried about? Is this something that we can help with? So face-to-face and having a one-on-one conversation. If they're needing support, trying to facilitate that. Two really pragmatic things to keep in mind is planning from a legal perspective, documenting what's happening for them. If you've got a family or friend who needs that support, keeping a log of the behaviours when they've happened and making a bit of a safety plan. When things get harder, when I'm going to leave, what does that look like? Who can I go to for support? And one of the things we kind of commonly hear in conversations is, I'm not really sure if I'm being abused. I feel unsafe, but I don't know if other people would see that as abuse. I'm not sure if I'll get the support I need. A really great source of information and support is the eSafety Commission. Keeping in mind places like 1-800-RESPECT. And there are a range of really useful websites and supports that can be a great place to start for people who might find it hard. You know, they want some information themselves. And so I'd point out two things. One is you could be a good friend by sitting and looking at a website together on your device that you know isn't being monitored by someone else. Or do you know about these quick exit buttons on websites? Most websites like 1-800-RESPECT, eSafety, will have a quick exit button really big on the page so that if I've Googled and I've gone to that page and I'm trying to access support, but I hear my violent partner is coming to the room or is coming to the house, if you hit quick exit, that will clear the browser and go to Google. Just having in mind some of these, how do we increase information and support while also doing it in a safe way? And remember, you can't come at this and expect complete separation between victim, survivor and perpetrator. It's not always what the victim, survivor wants. Often women don't want to be completely cut off and they don't want a shame or a kind of alienation of perpetrators. They want behaviour change and supports to be offered.
And people have a relationship with each other that is built up over time. There is love there. There's a history there. So it's not black and white.
Just recently, a report came out by the Australian Institute of Criminology, I think, And they're looking at restorative justice in intimate partner violence. And that's kind of, that's tricky. Some people would say, well, the coercion, the control is so strong that how could you ever have restorative justice? Like, and we know that perpetrators are currently using the justice system in separation, like stretching out hearings or using it as a further means to control. But where we have women and families that want to heal and move forward, whether that means being together in the long run or not, I thought that was really interesting and an important move in Australia to be thinking about, yeah, what is the role of restorative justice in this context? And I think that would really challenge people who haven't experienced coercive control or intimate partner violence directly. It might really challenge the perspectives that people have of there's violence in the relationship, just leave. And it's moving towards understanding what victim survivors want and how to support them better.
Sounds like a positive way forward, actually, and a good place to end our interview on. So thank you very much for being with us today. It's been quite illuminating. I think it'll be incredibly interesting to our listeners. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Donna. I really appreciate it.
I'm now joined by my colleague, Sonia Maria. Hi, Sonia. What did you think of that?
It's a really interesting interview, Donna.
And what issues arose for you as you were listening to it?
When she was talking about digital control and she mentioned the word doxing, I automatically went to Google because I was thinking at the time, so what's, you know, this whole digital era, the last sort of 5-10 years, that's really changed things in the way that abuse is now happening and coercive control. The idea that you can stalk people without them knowing it, you can bully them, you can bully people anonymously or set up fake profiles, you can get their photograph and create deep fakes, you can do all this horrible stuff to people digitally. And I wondered if in Australia we had updated our legislation and our laws to cope with that. I was thinking, so if you're an abuser and you get caught for that these days, is there a law that's going to, you know, work on behalf of the abused person and actually make this a criminal thing, or have we not kept up with it? So interestingly, I did a bit of a Google, and the federal government has introduced new criminal offences for doxing since 2024. So I thought that was good. So this penalty is up to 6 years imprisonment for doxing and up to 7 years for a group or someone who's been bullied and targeted. So I thought that was really good.
That is really good, isn't it? And it's really good to hear Jasmine talking about how you can prove coercive control through digital methods as well, that you must keep a record of it, keep evidence of it. And then when you go to the police and say that you've got a problem, then it's very clear that you do indeed have a problem, and that over this period of time, this person has committed these infringements at these particular times, and this is what they've said, this is what they've done, this is what methods they've used. I think that is probably the most valuable part of the radio show. Telling us what to do, and maybe also the telling us how to support other people. I thought it was really valuable when she said, don't communicate with them over digital means. Meet with them in person. Use your computer.
That's right. And don't use words like coercive control. Put it into normal words, you know. Do you feel like you're being limited from seeing your friends, or, you know, are you feeling isolated? Those kind of things that are the results of it, and maybe helping them to try and identify those kind of things rather than the fancy words that are more, you know, an academic point of view.
Yes, and words they'd be more comfortable with and be able to realise that they do have a problem. Are you able to have your own phone number? Do you want your own phone number, and are you able to have it? So for the 16 days of activism for this year around digital abuse, I hope our listeners have taken something from that show that's really helpful. Okay, well, we have a break now. We have a break over December, January and February. And we will resume recording Conversations for a Brave New World in March next year.
Looking forward to another great year again, Donna.
Me too.
Thank you for listening. This show is brought to you by the Gender Network. To get involved or find out more, simply Google the Gender Network at Charles Sturt.